Bethard is letting it go deep, and it is batted around and incomplete. And the game is over. It will be. Let's see, 7 seconds to go, but the Eagles take over on downs. The Eagles take over on downs.
Game is over.
They win for George Kittle.
That was the final play of Sunday night's Niners-Eagles game, in which the Philadelphia Eagles batted away a Hail Mary to secure their first victory of 2020, and also first place in the NFC East. Bill Barnwell shares his insights on why the Eagles, Giants, Cowboys, and Washington now comprise the very worst division in football. And then I ask Bill to examine how the weekend's new positive COVID tests will be felt by the league at large. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, October 5th. This is ESPN Daily. Alrighty, 3, 2, 1. Bill Barnwell, there is service journalism, and then there is what we are doing here tonight, staying up past midnight to dissect a division that mostly reminds me of a catchphrase I once saw on the movie poster for Alien vs. Predator. Whoever wins, we lose.
You know, blessedly, the Eagles were able to overcome two, not just one, but two 49ers backup quarterbacks and upset the defending NFC champions in San Francisco. In doing so, the Eagles ensured that we are not going to be talking about the worst division of the last 50 years.
Oh.
With Philadelphia's victory, taking the NFC East to 3-12-1 after 4 weeks, we are only dealing with the second worst division of the last 50 years after 4 weeks. The worst since the AFC Central in 1984. So 36 years since we have seen a division this bad through its first four games.
Wow. So, yeah, let's start there. Let's start with the quote-unquote good, which is the Eagles that we just watched hold on for dear life and get the aforementioned very first win of their season. Mm-hmm. So we saw Carson Wentz take on that thoroughly banged-up Niners roster that started with Nick Mullins at quarterback and then finished with C.J. Beathard at quarterback after Mullins basically just set himself on fire with a pick six toward the end of the game. And so Wentz's Eagles won 25-20, and they are in first place in this glorious second worst division of the last 50 years with a record of, wait for it, 1-2-1 after the tie they played for last week. How the hell did it take the Eagles so long to get a win?
I would say the Eagles have been too generous with their giveaways. The three games, their turnover margin was -7, the worst in football. And I don't want to bring up crusty football stats. I don't want to be the old coach talking about the simplest thing that everybody knows if you follow football. But it matters. The turnover battle matters. And the Eagles under Doug Peterson were 23-3 when they won the turnover battle. And before last night, 6-19-1 when they didn't, including their two losses and their tie in 2020. And this did not get off to a good start, Pablo. Carson Wentz threw a first quarter interception. That has been an enormous problem for the Eagles. Wentz had thrown exactly 7 picks in 2017, 2018, and 2019. It's pretty good. Mm. He's thrown 7 picks in 4 games in 2020. That's not as good. We maybe shouldn't have been surprised. You look at Football Outsiders numbers. They had graded Wentz as the luckiest quarterback in the league last year in terms of dropped interceptions. So you kind of expected it to increase, maybe not to a 28 interception pace, which is what Carson Wentz is on. But I've criticized them enough. The good news for the Eagles is that things did turn around after that early interception. They forced Nick Mullins to throw a pick in the red zone to save at least 3 points in the second quarter. That was Philadelphia's first interception of the season, by the way, and they weren't done. Gervon LeBlanc, one of the best names in football, strip-sacked Mullins in the fourth quarter, and then the Eagles forced him to the sideline after what I can only describe as an inexplicable pick six. So the third takeaway of the game. The 49ers did get back in the game with C.J. Beathard, but the points the Eagles generated and saved off of the turnovers they'd been lacking helped them win their game, if not, in addition, save their season as well.
So I just want the record to show that the Philadelphia Eagles turned Bill Barnwell into like a John Gruden turnover battle, crusty, cliche, spewing analyst. That's a first.
The
man.
Analytics don't matter anymore, Papa. When you get to this level of football, it's just like Pee Wee football. You just want them to hold on to the football, have fun, not get hurt, and at least run in the right direction.
So let's talk about a team that is running in the opposite of the right direction. Yes. Because the Dallas Cowboys, man, Browns Cowboys, this was the game of the day, unless you rooted for the Dallas Cowboys, because the resurgent Cleveland Browns beat the Cowboys 49-38, even though the Browns almost went full Falcon and allowed Dallas to score 24 points in the fourth quarter. But then Baker Mayfield pitched the ball to Odell Beckham on a genuinely breathtaking end around.
Here's Mayfield on a reverse. They're going to give it to Beckham. He's rolling to the right and running. He's up to the 50, to the 45, to the 40, 35, 30. There he goes to the 20, 15, 10, 5. Touchdown! OBJ, he's got a hat trick.
What a gutsy call.
What led to the Cowboys' demise on Sunday? And is there anything America's now 1-3 team can do to fix things?
Well, Pablo, it's bad that the Cowboys have a formula for losing games after 4 weeks of the season, but they do. This is a game where they gave away two fumbles in the first half, which directly led to 14 points for the Browns. The offense was hot early, eventually got going again in the second half. Dak Prescott ended up topping 500 passing yards in this game and has more passing yards than any quarterback in league history through four games by over 130 passing yards. Despite the fact that the Browns lost star running back Nick Chubb to a first half injury, Cleveland ran for 307 yards. That is the most the Cowboys have ever allowed in a single game of football. And the Cowboys did get back in this game. They were within 4 points after their last touchdown and 2-point conversion. And then that play, Alton Smith was in the backfield there to make a play, and Beckham just kind of ignored him, just ran right past him, turned upfield, and then didn't even need to break a tackle to take his 50-yard run to the house. Just when it looked like the Cowboys were getting on track and getting back to the team maybe we expected before the season, their defense lapsed again. They really miss defensive tackle Gerald McCoy and linebacker Leighton Vander Esch, both of whom are injured, more than anything else. They're wasting an incredible offense, and whether it's signing some veterans off the street just to have guys who know what they're doing, at the very least, like cycling some guys in and out, something has to change because the Cowboys' formula on defense just is not working.
So speaking of formulas that are not working at all, Bill, our shared childhood team, the New York Giants, they were hoping to get their first win of the season against the Rams today. And spoiler alert, they did not. They lost 17-8. Of the two teams with New York in their name, which one should be less optimistic about their future?
Like, it's literally pieces of the bottom of the barrel being compared to one another. which part of the barrel is better? The best argument I can make for either side is that the Giants are better off because they play in the NFC East, and the NFC East is hot garbage. They're still in the division race right now. I mean, they can kind of be proud of what the defense did on Sunday. They faced a Rams team that had been very explosive on offense, and they held them to 17 points. That's holding up their end of the bargain.
I want to check in, Bill, on my favorite team, whose name also sounds like it exists in one of those movies that doesn't have legal clearance to use any NFL trademarks, the Washington football team. So the football team got run over by Lamar Jackson and the Ravens 31-17 for their third straight loss. And at 1-3, they are now tied, wait for it, for second place in the NFC East. So does the football team actually have a shot at winning this division?
Maybe in that movie, they might have a shot at winning the division. In real life, I don't think so. But it's a problem because their defense really could have held up and been competitive. The only way this team was really going to get hot would have been if the defensive line had just been overwhelming opposing offenses, which is exactly what we saw in the week one victory over the Eagles. But since then, they've lost second overall pick Chase Young to a groin injury and wildly underrated lineman Matt Ioannidis, which is just a fun name to say, let's be honest, is done for the year with a torn biceps. And this would have been a fun matchup with the that great Washington defensive line when everyone's healthy against the dominant Ravens rushing offense. But the injuries just, they matter.
Now that we've taken a scan of each of these teams, I am curious about the collective big picture. Like, why and how is this division so terrible? And do you think the division can actually turn itself around?
It sort of feels like every one of these teams sort of made a bet when they were building their roster. Like, they all knew, okay, we're going to be good at something. And we're going to sacrifice not being good at something, but we kind of think the thing we're good at will overcome the thing we're not good at. None of those formulas have worked, and you're sort of left with, you know, the husks of these four teams that, you know, can occasionally spark a big play or two, but just can't seem to hold up for any extended period of time. And I think as the season goes on, it's going to come down to which of these four teams can vaguely approximate their preseason plan over the remaining 12 games of the season.
So, Bill, someone has to win this thing.
I would like to see a universe where the NFC East defies the odds and nobody wins. But it seems like it's unlikely. I don't think even this year will be an exception. I'm going to stick with the Cowboys. They're not going to keep fumbling away two touchdowns per game to the opposing team in the first half. And I will say this, my one request for the NFC East after their slow start. This is probably going to be the last 16-game season in NFL history, which means it's probably the last chance we will have to see an NFL team make the playoffs with 7 wins. I believe, and I hope, and I dream for a 7-9 Dallas Cowboys team to win the NFC East.
That is precisely the crusty football coach motivational speech that I needed anti-analytics Bill Barnwell to deliver.
You just got to get to 7. That's all you need, guys.
All right, after the break, Phil, I want to talk about where things stand after a weekend of yet more positive COVID tests that are cropping up around the NFL, and also the ripple effects that we're going to see in the weeks to come.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Bill, as we speak right now on Sunday night, we are still reacting to what's been a steady drip, drip, drip of positive COVID tests that have been leaking out across the NFL. So, as one example of this chaos, the Saints-Lions game actually did end up happening because there was a positive coronavirus test from a player yesterday, but he was retested and came up negative today. So we got to see all of that game in its glory. But how much does everything kind of feel up in the air to you right now?
I mean, it feels like every game is sort of subject to these issues. I mean, last night I went to sleep, not sure whether the Raiders and Lions were going to play. And then I woke up Sunday morning and they were going to play, and I'm not leaving my apartment, to be clear, all day. You can imagine what it's like for players who flew across the country or flew from New Orleans to Detroit and had to get tested. I mean, we're sort of ending up with these situations where teams simultaneously have to prepare for the possibility of playing or resting without knowing which is going to happen. Take the Steelers, who are supposed to play Tennessee this week before the Titans outbreak. They knew something was up early in the week. But the Steelers still had to practice in midweek as if they were going to play before the game was finally postponed on Friday. the Steelers are taking their bye week now, and there's not any sort of quantitative disadvantage or history of teams with early bye weeks being at a disadvantage. But the reality is they didn't really get to have a bye week where you can go home and rest and physically, mentally, and emotionally disconnect from football. And you have to figure that's going to hurt them, even though they didn't do anything wrong.
So what was supposed to be today's marquee game, Bill, Patriots-Chiefs, it got rescheduled for Monday night at 7.05 p.m. on CBS. So how was the decision made to play this thing on Monday just a day later? And what extra precautions are we going to see?
Okay, so we saw the NFL establish this precedent last week. The Falcons had first-round pick A.J. Terrell test positive on Friday. They found out on Saturday. But because none of their other players tested positive, the game with the Bears went on Sunday. Now, they could have used Terrell, who happens to be a very talented young cornerback, during their collapse against Chicago. Now you fast forward a week. We saw the NFL again try to keep things as close to normalcy as possible. Cam tested positive on Friday. The Patriots found out on Saturday morning. Newton then went into quarantine. The Patriots sent their players home and waited to get their latest set of test results before organizing two planes to Kansas City, one for the players who had been around Cam, which numbers about 20 people, and one for the rest of the organization who had not. Now, obviously, we know that there are still players who could have caught the coronavirus from Newton who haven't yet tested positive, but will in the days to come, or could in the days to come. The Patriots organization knows this, which is why they had those 20 contacts on a separate plane. The safest thing for the NFL to do would have been to delay the game until everyone had passed maybe a week of testing to make sure the virus hadn't spread. But the NFL is apparently comfortable enough with the risk of a delayed positive to play the game on a one-day delay, which is what they're doing on Monday. That's a calculated risk. It's not a decision based on safety.
And the upside of that risk is that now we get a spontaneous Monday night doubleheader, Patriots-Chiefs, and then Falcons-Packers at 8:50 p.m. on ESPN. So looking at the Chiefs' schedule in specific, I want to dive into this somewhat. How will this sudden shift in schedule impact Kansas City down the stretch?
It hurts them. They have a suddenly compacted schedule. They'll face the Patriots on Monday with Brian Hoyer at quarterback for New England. And then they'll have two consecutive short weeks. They'll play the Raiders on Sunday and then the Bills the following Thursday on Thursday Night Football. And the reality is just that teams are going to have to deal with this over the course of the season. It's out of their control. And take again the Steelers as a good example. They didn't have an outbreak. They appear to be following all of the rules. And their schedule was flipped after the Titans outbreak. This isn't likely to be the last outbreak. And teams are going to complain privately, but they're going to have a stiff upper lip publicly.
Yeah, I mean, we should note also, it is certainly very scary and very serious that Cam Newton and any of these guys tested positive for COVID. But in terms of ripping up game plans, I wonder, Bill, like the Patriots as a football team, with him definitively unable to play this week, I imagine there's going to be a crater left in his absence. So where do things stand for the Patriots offense without Cam Newton?
Of course, I mean, they're fundamentally a different offense. They rebuilt their offense from the ground up in Cam's image and practiced it for the entire summer. There are a few old components mixed in, some play action concepts, some stuff here and there. But running this offense with Brian Hoyer would be like if the Heat replaced Bam Adebayo's minutes with Pat Riley. I mean, it's a fundamentally different type of human being. So I think the Patriots can survive with Hoyer if they have to for a few weeks, but I think it's particularly going to hurt them in this matchup against the Chiefs, where Hoyer hasn't practiced with the first team and is coming in for this game on a couple of days' notice.
And as disruption goes, by the way, it is important, it's crucial to point out that, oh yeah, right, what's happening to the Pats and Chiefs is not actually close to the biggest outbreak in the NFL. That would be the Tennessee Titans, who you alluded to. And the Titans, their game against the Steelers today had already been postponed. But as the positives continue to add up, and as of Sunday night, they're up to 8 players and 8 staffers who've tested positive, it also seems logical that Tennessee's home game against the Bills next weekend might also be in jeopardy. So how far-reaching is the domino effect once you calculate all of these postponements across the league here?
I mean, a handful of teams have already been hit. The NFL had to reschedule that Steelers-Titans game, and to accomplish that, they moved Pittsburgh's bye up to week 4. The Ravens, move their bye from week 8 to week 7, which allowed the Steelers to play Tennessee in week 7 and then move the Ravens-Steelers game that had been scheduled in week 7 to week 8. Mm. That's one run of positives with one team, impacted four teams, three of which had nothing to do with the situation at all. And if anything, if you're looking for some modicum of good news, it's that this happened before the bye week, because things are about to get very messy if the NFL continues to have COVID outbreaks. Major League Baseball, we'll start there. Major League Baseball had stretches where teams like the Marlins and the Cardinals basically needed to hit pause on their seasons. Mm. Baseball is able to get past that by rescheduling games and playing shortened 7-inning doubleheaders. NFL teams cannot do that. If the Titans do have to postpone that Bills game, there is a way they could go about it. I actually tweeted about this last week. Usually I have bad ideas on Twitter. This is a rare exception where I think I might have a good idea. The NFL has a built-in free week late in the season. There are 2 weeks between the conference championship games and the Super Bowl. The league would love to keep the Super Bowl on its current schedule and play in Tampa Bay on February 7th as planned. By pushing the first three rounds of the playoffs back a week and eliminating that extra week between the conference championships and the Super Bowl, the league could create a week 18 to fill in any extra games which have to get pushed back or postponed during the regular season. For example, if the Titans have to delay two games, now they could push that game back to week 18. It's not going to solve things in every situation. If a team needs to postpone multiple games after their bye, things are going to be in serious trouble. But if that happens, the league's going to need a more robust solution anyway.
I am rooting for the Barnwell plan. Capital B, capital P. I hope you get all the credit in the world if the NFL does what it often does, Bill Barnwell, which is read your column and steal strategically from it. So, Bill, how are NFL coaches and other leaders around the league, how are they reacting to this emergent chaos right now?
Well, I mean, Papa, let's start with the college football example, right? I mean, it's college football rosters are bigger than NFL rosters. And as you know, there's not a union for college football players, which I think are the two biggest reasons why the college football community has decided to go on with these games without much concerns. There are a few reasons why the NFL didn't go into a bubble like the NBA or NHL did. I mean, just to start, the logistics of having everybody in a bubble would have been virtually impossible on size alone. NFL rosters are twice as big as baseball rosters and four times as big as your typical NBA roster. And NFL teams have more support staff than those in other sports. You'd be looking at basically about 100 people for each NFL team. So 3,200 people around the NFL all going into one city. Mm. In addition, the NBA and NHL really only needed the bubble to play out their postseason. The NFL would need to bubble for 4 months just to play their regular season, let alone the postseason. Instead, knowing this, the NFL instituted a virtual football bubble, which I will clarify means no bubble. The players are wearing trackers inside the facility to allow for contact tracing, but they don't have to wear their tracers outside of the building. And because they're not in a bubble, they can interact with people who aren't subject to the NFL's level of testing. The NFL is testing every day, and that's great. And Tennessee's outbreak has changed things. It's prompted the league to insist that players stay in their home city during their bye weeks while continuing testing during that week off. But it's just not realistic for the league to go from their current situation to one huge bubble overnight. And I'm sure every team has done research into how they might pull this off if they have to. But again, you're changing the rules of what you expect from players. And if that happens, there are going to be players who decide it's just not worth it to keep playing under those situations.
Bill Barnwell, thank you for joining, as you always do, our virtual football bubble on Sunday night.
I wish I could stay in the virtual football bubble all week, Pablo, but unfortunately I have to get back to my other job.
Yeah, you should probably go write the column that the NFL is going to steal from. Coming up, over the weekend, we said goodbye to an athlete who made me want to relive October surprises past, specifically one from 1968.
Delicious, meat, nutritious. in the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each one-ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. On October 2nd, 1968, just months after Martin Luther King got assassinated and weeks before Richard Nixon got elected, Bob Gibson won Game 1 of the World Series by striking out 17 Detroit Tigers. The single greatest performance by one of the best athletes ever. It happened during one of the most turbulent years in American history, in the thick of protests around the Civil Rights Movement and Vietnam War.
He got him! Struck him out! Look at the scene on the field, McCarver, the first one. Now his infielders all over him. A new world record of 17 strikeouts in one game.
In fact, Gibson 17 is still the World Series record today, in 2020. And I found myself going back and watching that game this weekend on YouTube, where MLB posted the full black and white NBC broadcast from 68.
Bob Gibson, in your new book, From Ghetto to Glory, right now, probably one of your most glorious moments. World Series records all over the place. Congratulations.
Thanks a lot, just great.
The fans just stood and cheered you. That must be your most thrilling moment in sports. You've had many.
Well, I guess so. I didn't know what they were cheering about, and Tim came out in front of the plate, and I just turned around and looked at the scoreboard. I had no idea.
The best pitcher in St. Louis Cardinals history and the best big game pitcher of all time died from pancreatic cancer at age 84 on October 2nd, 2020, last Friday night. It was the 52nd anniversary of the most thrilling moment of Bob Gibson's career, and just the latest morbid echo of historical symmetry in America. But as I revisited that day in 68 this weekend, Gibson felt very much alive.
And walking slowly to the mound, Bob Gibson, who set a new National League record for earned run average this year, 1.12.
You could see his eyes, those intimidating eyes, staring out from under his cap. You could see his legs, those flying legs, one of which Gibson had ridden for 3 batters in 67 after it got broken by a line drive. And you could see his arm, that unforgettable right arm, the one responsible for maybe the best year a pitcher has ever had. Gibson's 1.12 ERA in 68 is also still a modern record. It's a number so indelible that MLB lowered the pitcher's mound 5 inches in 69, the year after, in a futile attempt to level the playing field by literally leveling the playing field. And rewatching Gibson strike out 17, I get why baseball tried. Bob Gibson was so good that he seemed unfair. He was so good that he continues to stand out in our memory, despite those huge shadows of 68, that year of insane chaos and racial anger and political unrest, which all now feels kind of reassuring, actually, 52 years later. Because maybe we will also remember something beyond the chaos and the anger and the unrest of 2020. Maybe this year we'll also have days, surprises in October, that we'd like to live again. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.